So, I changed the title to my talk from what's on the board, because this is what I'm going to be talking about. It's related. It's the U.S. borderlands and the residue of history, immigration, culture, and identity. And this, these three topics will guide us through what starts off as an exploration of U.S. history and pre-U.S. history, and on to the current climate, as well as the context of what a borderlands means. And so when we talk about history, it's important that we take responsibility for our place in it, as well as where we speak from. And since you're new to the group, tell us your name, please, and your mother's mother's name and the language that she spoke.
My name's Barbara Aguero. My mother's mother's name was Alwilda Ophelia Collistan Tollefson, and she spoke Norwegian and English.
Very good. Thank you. Since you are new to the group, please tell us your name, your mother's mother's name, and the language that she spoke.
My mother's mother. I'm John, and my mother's mother's name was Katie Cowan. And she spoke English.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
This is part of locating ourselves in the world, on the face of the earth, and tying us back to our ancestors, right? Because we're talking about the residue of history. Now, as I was saying, positioning is important, and that's part of what I try to do with my opening, is to locate us. And it's also important we talk about things. History does not spring full-formed out of nowhere, nor does information. And that's why it's important that we take responsibility for these things. And so I am Octavio Carrasco, PhD. I prefer to just be called Octavio. I am a Mexican-American. Half of my family came from English Protestants and German Protestants, including on the Mayflower. Well, the other half of my family is from North Mexico, indigenous people, and the border. So my grandfather, the house that he was born in, the end of the block is fence. And the fence was not there when he was born in 1919. And so this informs how I understand this information, and part of what I bring to the material is this complicated intersection of cultures colliding, not always nicely. El Paso, Texas is, of course, on the border between U.S. and Mexico at this time. Now, it's also important just to say that the border between U.S. and Mexico was not always where it is today. In fact, the United States was not a country for 1,000 years. When was the United States founded?
1776.
Everybody knows 1776. So prior to that, this landmass was here still, and there were still people on it. So there you go. I'm just getting going here. So one of the other things, I've already touched on this, but power in the production of history, the way that we tell narratives, the way that certain people are heroes and other people are victims or people are left out altogether. And this informs how we imagine, how we think, how we talk about things, right? Just this simple name of America, referring to the U.S., when obviously the Americas include many countries, both in the North and the Southern Hemisphere, and the Caribbean. And there's all kinds of cultural history and language and things happening all across this. So, framing is important, and how we talk about things matters. So, what does borderlands mean? What do you think of when you hear the word?
Arizona, Texas.
Okay.
California, things on the southern border, and then in Mexico, the northern states.
Okay. So geographically, the southwest and the northeast of Mexico. Northwest.
Northwest, yeah.
We're going to come back to that. What else does the borderlands mean?
Between two places.
Between two places.
Currently, a lot of controversy over building walls.
Currently? Controversy around walls. Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like Barbara, I also think of like the southern U.S. and northern Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't ever think about like Canada.
I was just thinking that too. I don't ever think.
I think
of Canada.
It's like maybe where there's more of an obvious cultural difference, it stands out as like being a border or something mm-hmm. like that. Because when I go from Bellingham, where I'm from, to Vancouver, it doesn't feel like very different. And I guess I haven't had the experience of driving across the southern border, so I can't speak to that. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting because I thought the same thing.
So when you go into Canada, you don't experience a dramatic change
right.
in your identity or in the culture around you.
Right. At least in the Northwest.
Okay.
When I go across the border, yeah.
That's an important example. Anything else about what borderlands means?
Regulation and laws, ability to pass and not pass, rules.
Yeah.
Lots of rules.
So, right, a legislative border where, just as you were just speaking about, where your identity changes, where you become almost somebody else, right? A tourist or a visitor or somebody subject to a different set of laws.
When you come back into the U.S. from somewhere else, you cross the border and you have no rights in that place.
Right.
You lose your rights. They can do whatever they want.
A liminal space without autonomy, perhaps? I don't know. We're going to come back to that, too. Anything else about borders, borderlands? What is the residue of history?
Seems to me it's things that stay in place that don't serve a purpose anymore.
Okay.
They're just kind of
so
left behind.
Remnants of the past. Perhaps with greater significance.
In the past.
In the past.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, things like monuments of war and conflict at the border in San Antonio, the Alamo, and all of that sort of stuff that reminds you of conflict between peoples.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so monuments are symbols that have different meanings to different groups based on political differences in the past. Specifically, the idea of a fort, the Alamo, it still stands today, right? Certainly. What else might the residue of history mean?
Confederate flags.
Aha. Uh-huh.
What'd you say, Lee?
Confederate flags.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going
and
to go
statues.
Off on that.
I think of residue as something you don't really want.
Okay.
It's a leftover thing, a byproduct that, oops, we spilled that. We couldn't get it up.
And it sort of clings. Like it can be a remnant.
Yes.
Residue, like, latches on and stays.
It was not easily cleaned up. It's still there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Something left behind, like in the kitchen. You don't want residue in there, right? Well, I have good news and bad news. There's a tremendous amount of residue of history in this country, and you see it in place names, you see it in architecture, you see it in language and food and culture and music. And part of the reason I like the word residue in this case, because a lot of the myths, the stories of the United States and 1776 and Manifest Destiny and the Pilgrims and all of these things, July 4th, this tells one story and it leaves out all this other stuff. And part of what inspires me when I talk about borderlands is, look, there's all this stuff that's left. It's in the ground. And it's not just in the ground, it's above the ground in many circumstances. But in the Southwest, when people go looking for arrowheads, for example, this is the residue of history. Mesa Verde, near where I grew up, there's the cave dwellings and the cave paintings. This is archaeology. But more than that, you have place names like San Francisco or all the missions along the West Coast, left over from the Spanish days. And it's all throughout the Southwest. And even more, you could say, Seattle as a place with a residue, obviously because of the origins of the name, but also because of the underground part of the city, which is literally the city from before. It's been covered over, but it's still down there. And that's just from 1850, so you can get going with this. And a big part of this, of course, is, I don't know how familiar you are with Seattle, they say that there's a statue of Lenin, not John. Lenin in Fremont, and people argue about this statue, and they paint his hands red. And one of the things that's important to realize is that that is not a statue of Lenin. The statue is of somebody else. And people just associate this name with the statue, and all of a sudden everybody knows it's the statue of Lenin. You can see it on the map, but it's not really a statue of Lenin. So,
who's the statue?
That part's complicated. They found it lying in a ditch, brought it over to the U.S. There's controversy over how much it costs and who will buy it. And the point is, people can get upset about it, and Fremont can show how cool it is because it has. But this is not uncommon. The statue at Harvard of the founder is not really of. That's not John Harvard in the chair there. It's a workman that showed up that day. This happens a lot. In Haiti, the great statue of Christopher Columbus is not of Christopher Columbus. This happens all the time. So, oops. What do you see here?
Huh? Florida upside
down. Gulf of Mexico.
So you recognize it?
Cuba are huge.
What's different about this picture?
It's upside down.
It's upside down. And what I really like about this particular picture is you can see that we've actually flipped a picture that was so-called right side up, because the words are upside down too. Okay, but so this is recognizable, let's say. But already, hopefully, you're starting to think about it a little differently. Because what would happen if north was south? Okay. So, obviously U.S. history involves colonialism, and colonialism involves people from one place coming to another place and encountering and colliding with. In the case of North America, it obviously includes African slaves. And so it's not a story of European exploration. This is a story of, as my teacher Charles Longman put it, Aboriginal African Euro culture. The point is, U.S. history is very complicated, and that's just the starting place, because as we've already shown from the people in this room, we have all kinds of different ancestors. And history is not just a story of victors. We say that a lot. But the culture does not work just in one direction. Culture works in many directions. And so why is the national dish of England curry? So part of the thing is when we envision the idea of the New World and the Puritans coming to the New World, it was already a diverse place. There were all kinds of languages and cultures spoken by the indigenous people. They didn't always get along. They didn't always see things the same way. There was a great deal of conflict all the time, and different languages and so on and so forth. So we're going to come back to that. So before it was America, the name that we all think of, it was still already diverse because you had the Spanish Empire, you had the French Empire, you had the, do you guys know about New Sweden? New Sweden was formed by the Lutherans in what is now Delaware. They didn't last very long, but there was a colony of New Sweden. And one of my favorites, the city of New Amsterdam. Did anybody know what that was?
New York.
New York City founded in 1647, 1547, I forget. They decided not to invest in defending New York City, New Amsterdam at times efficiently because they thought it was going to be an economic backwater. I always like that. And Wall Street was there to keep the English out, just to clarify. So, excellent. It was always diverse. This is a diverse world we live in. Now, we already talked about this: place names, architecture, food, culture, and language. This is what's not just left over, it's being made fresh in different cultures, people living together, that we invent new things, we find new things in old things, new things come to color the way that we see or understand or eat. And obviously we were playing some music prior to most of you coming in. What did it sound like?
I thought it sounded Cuban, since we have a Cuban musician in the village.
What instruments did you notice?
Oh.
Well, one of the instruments was the accordion. And what does the accordion remind you of?
Polka music.
Polka music. That's why I was like playing it for German folks, because they're like, oh, this, you know, they're like standing there, you know, tapping their feet, and it's like...
But it's also like Zydeco from... Mm-hmm. And it's also klezmer, used in klezmer music in Eastern Europe.
There you go.
Very big, who knows?
Mexican music.
Yeah. Mexican.
That's what we were playing, Mexican-American. The song is Mexicano, Americano, Mexican-American. Here you go. So, we're going to talk more about music tomorrow. So the borderlands are a historical reality. A geopolitical space as well as a way of thinking. Before we get on a bunch of words, let's look at some pictures. Okay. So what is this?
Spanish North America.
Probably Mexico before.
The native people.
That's one of the reasons I like it. There's a list of native tribes on this map also. But what do you recognize?
States that are current.
Right. And that's part of what I want to say here. Everybody can imagine the map of... Many people can imagine the map of the United States. They teach this to you in school over and over and over again. The 50 states with certain boundaries and... And I like that, right, Alaska was admitted in 1959, right? So prior to that, it was only 49 states, and so on and so forth. But we grew up with this idea of 50 states in the U.S., and we can picture them with the lines, which you see here, dotted lines, of what is sort of the South. We call it the South-Southwest. But so that's... My hope is that you think about the geography differently. And what's also good about this map is you have these lines, the shape of California, right, the shape of Texas, Louisiana, it's all on there. But it also highlights that this was a land before any of that happened, and there were already people on the land. And part of what this is, the Spanish borderlands, this guy, Herbert Eugene Bolton, he loves the Spaniards. He wants us to all admire how courageous and strong they were to colonize North America. Another lens of history. But the thing that he also does is he says this history is not just that of Puritans. The Spanish were here. And in fact, the Spanish went all the way up to Alaska. They explored all over around here. There were missions and presidios all over the Southwest. And, of course, the French were all over the north and coming down through the Mississippi River. And we're going to talk some more about the conflict over New Orleans. I always like the story that people could not find the mouth of the Mississippi River. This was a contest between European powers to try to locate the end of the Mississippi River, which sounds like a joke, because they found the river, they just couldn't find where it ended. A whole other thing there. So, Spain settled or at least claimed all of this. And one of the very early conflicts was between the French Protestants and the Spanish Catholics. So a great deal of the exploration of the New World is carryover of the religious and political conflicts in Europe. So, and that's another thing to understand is the history of the U.S. leave this out partly because the U.S. is not concerned with European politics, but leading to that, everybody was looking for gold cities. They were also looking for the Northwest Passage. The Northwest Passage, I always like this story. You know the Strait of Juan de Fuca? The waterway that goes above the Olympic Peninsula and into in between Canada and the U.S. And in 1592, Juan de Fuca, allegedly, wrote down that he'd found the Northwest Passage. And he'd written down that it was between the 47th and 48th parallels. And, of course, the Strait of Juan de Fuca is not the Northwest Passage. But once again, it took people 200 years to find this waterway again, which is still not the Northwest Passage. What I'm trying to say here is the European powers were all up in the New World competing over claims to something that isn't really there, along with gold cities, which were also not there. This drove the Spaniards to incredible lengths, and everybody else to incredible lengths, looking for gold that they never found. And let's note that not finding gold encouraged them to look harder. The failure of Coronado's expedition led to more searching for gold. So, psychologically, this is an interesting sort of experiment in terms of how far can you get people to go for something that they don't find. I guess they did find the Northwest Passage more recently, and it goes up above Greenland, and it's not important anymore in the same way. Which Greenland is. So, once again, this is another map. There you go, North America. The United States is on this map, supposedly. But this is not a map of the United States. This is a map of the Spanish claims in North America and the Caribbean. And I always also like to tell the story of Cabeza de Vaca. They set out looking for gold cities. And they set out from here, and they ran into trouble, and they went inland, and they didn't find gold, and they're all wearing armor, and there's mosquitoes and malaria, and everybody's getting sick and dying, and they end up losing half their people, and they come back to shore, and the other boat that's supposed to meet them has left because what are they doing? They end up making boats out of their horses and sails out of their clothes, so they're just wearing armor in the hot Gulf of Mexico. They end up losing. It started off with 600 people, and they end up with four. And these four folks walk over the course of 8 years all the way over here and down before they meet other Spaniards. Cabeza de Vaca is the first person to write an account of the flora and fauna in what is the Southwest. And one of the members of his expedition that did not survive, ends up dying, is Estevanico. Estevanico was a Moor. So one of the first Europeans to come to what is now New Mexico was actually an African. And this is all part important for the founding of Santa Fe, which we're probably going to skip over somewhat. What I'm trying to say is this is a different way to imagine our land mass and our history and our identity. And you see it more, and you mentioned our Zydeco music, you see it in these kind of ways where there's not just a difference of many kinds of instruments and the way that they're played, but the mixing of languages and food, I mean Creole, the whole idea of this, it's not just a sort of cultural trend, it has to do with where people come from and how they understand the world, right? And then, of course, there's the whole ranking of racial, right, the legal ranking of racial identity based on how much blood you have that's not white, which is a story for another time, but it's disturbing to think about. Okay, so a little bit more about the Spanish. The Spanish, they were Catholics, and they had an order from the Pope in 1492 that they could have anything they found west of a certain parallel that runs through Brazil with the Portuguese. The Portuguese could have everything to the east, the Spanish could have everything to the west. Part of the job was to claim for the crown and the church everything they found. And so Spain's sort of method was to set up missionary sites. At the same time, missionary sites don't really lead to a booming population growth, which is part of the thing they run into with the 13 colonies. The people in the 13 colonies were there to live and found towns and grow. And there's obviously a very big difference in the way that they thought about land and land use. The English colonies thought that because the Indians weren't using the land the way that they would, that they didn't have any claim to it. And the English approach was to take the land first and try to Christianize the Indians, and if you Christianize the Indians, then they became human beings. The Spanish approach was more that they were already human beings, you had to Christianize them first. Have it backwards. The Spanish viewed them as human beings. There was a big debate in Spain between Bartolomé de las Casas and Sepúlveda, and they literally had a debate over whether or not the indigenous people were humans. And the outcome of that debate was that Spain recognized the Indians as human beings, and so they would be made Christian and then converted to sort of Spanish culture, whereas the English had the opposite take. Which is, and both of these are tremendously harmful for the way of life of the indigenous people and their humanity. But this is part of the difference in this cultural collision. And obviously, again, we're talking about, this is all maps of conflicts of European powers. So even our effort to look at the Spanish borderlands leaves out much of the indigenous history, and that's partly because the indigenous history has been repeatedly destroyed or buried. So it's hard to find good sources on a lot of this stuff.
So is the purple French territory? Is that what that is?
This is the 13 colonies.
Oh, so that's English?
So this is the colonies pushing this way. The French are up here, but they came down here at some point. And
I guess, what are the different colors? Like, what is purple?
Yellow is Spain, orange is France, and pink or purple is England.
Okay.
But not England, it's the 13 colonies. Gotcha. And this is another part where so Spain and France fought over Florida for a long time. And so part of what the borderlands also then become is they're specifically a buffer zone between Spain and England / the colonies. So when you come to the founding of Texas, rather prior to the founding of Texas, Spain invites colonists to settle there. First they try to people it with people from the Canary Islands, but then they invite the Austin and Houston families to settle there. And they're each given, every family is given a huge tract of land from Spain. So the land of Texas is...
Is that their names, the Austin people and the Houston people?
Or? Yes.
Really?
Exactly.
Holy
what
cow.
Did you say, John?
I asked if that was their names, these families, the Austins and
Moses
the
Houstons.
Moses Austin. Wow.
So they are basically paid by the Spanish crown.
And they were colonists in...
Well, that my point is they're coming from the sort of Protestant burgeoning United States, right?
So those other little pink dots
around are people who came from the colonies?
No, no, these are settlements. I'm just saying in terms of the land that is Texas was first given to what become U.S. Americans by Spain in order to try to keep the rest of the colonists from expanding any further. So what becomes a territory of Texas is, right, it's Catholic, Spanish Catholic, and these people, the Austin family, is given all of this land, and they're asked to convert to Catholicism, and slavery is outlawed. And because the Protestants don't share this point of view, this becomes a point of contention. Now, when Mexico becomes independent from Spain, Austin goes to Mexico City and gets the land grants given by Spain renewed or reinforced. So this is important. The state of Texas, as we think about it, the land grants come from Spain and Mexico. So all the talk about Texas as a republic, Texas as a sort of the image that many people have of Texas, the history behind that is this land grant came from the Spanish crown and then Mexico City. And the part of the tension was over Catholic control and outlawing slavery, which, as we know due to our own history in the U.S., is a point of tension throughout the South. Whole long thing. Okay. So. So we've talked a lot about Spanish conflicts in the New World. Now, Louisiana. People talk about the French Quarter and New Orleans. The name, New Orleans, is a French name. And it's important to learn or think about. New Orleans, the Louisiana Territory, was given to Spain in 1765, thereabouts, because of Europolitics. However, the people that lived in Louisiana Territory were not interested in Europolitics. They already had a French influence and culture, and they were just fine being who they were. And so when Spain was given the rights to Louisiana, as the Louisiana Territory, the people resisted. And the new Spanish governor came in, and they eventually drove him out. Because they didn't want to be Spanish citizens. They didn't want to start behaving that way. And this is based on a kind of mixed culture that's already on the ground, right? So then the Spanish crown sends in somebody else to restore order, and this guy's name is Alejandro O'Reilly. And Alejandro O'Reilly is Irish Catholic, and he'd served in the Austrian War of Succession. So he is sent in to Louisiana to sort things out. And part of what happens is because of the background in Louisiana up to this point, the governor, the Spanish governor who was sent in and then driven out, is put in charge, but his second is a French nobleman. So, and that's part of the struggle over the politics on the ground locally in terms of how it relates to the powers in Europe and what the people on the ground think, what they're going to do. So when O'Reilly comes, the same French nobleman is still sort of second in command, making a very strange hybrid cultural government, as it were, in Louisiana. And O'Reilly, basically, he kind of charms everybody and says, "Ah, yes, we're here to have a nice time." And then he quietly executes everybody that was involved in the uprising against the prior Spanish governor. But at this point, it's all okay. And it becomes a wonderful, happy place forever and ever. Just kidding. So New Orleans, Louisiana, becomes a Spanish landholding for the next 40 years until 1802, Napoleon gets Louisiana back. I understand it has to do with giving his wife's brother a seat in Hungary or something, and for this, Louisiana is given back to France. And France then, of course, as we all know from our history books in the U.S., is sold to Thomas Jefferson. And part of the point of this is Spain never agreed to any of that, and they did not. Part of their agreement was you're not going to sell Louisiana territory to another power, right? Because it has the Spanish-French thing going on. Now, here's the other important part of this map. This is the Louisiana territory that was understood by the Europeans to be sold to the U.S. And this is the Louisiana Purchase they show you in your history books. I took 11 years of U.S. history in public school in this country, so I remember the visual very clearly, that the Louisiana Purchase goes all the way basically to Idaho. And what I'm trying to say here is that what we tell in our popular history in this country leaves out all of these other parts. And in this case, it's claiming all this land that's not recognized to be being sold. So we come back to the power and the production of history. Louisiana Purchase increases the size of the U.S. by 2/3, right? And once again, none of this has any recognition of the native people on the land or the kind of mixing that's happening, and the way that, let's say, different industries are taking part in exploiting the new landmass. And once again, there's a lot of these. The Spanish explorers, the French explorers, these people were going all over the place. Remember my story about Cabeza de Vaca walking across all of the Southwest. The journey that discovered San Francisco was, they walked from Mexico City, is my understanding. They were looking for Monterey, which is, you know, here, and they missed it, and they went too far, and they decided, I guess we're going to turn around now, and somebody went up on a hill, and they looked down, and they saw the San Francisco Bay. So they found San Francisco by accident. And it was called Yerba Buena. And so this is also a story of people, right, they're all looking for gold, they're all looking for the Northwest Passage, and they're finding all kinds of things, but it's not those. And there's obviously the richness of the culture on the land prior to that. Any questions or comments so far?
So what was the point of the Northwest Passage?
So Northwest Passage is supposed to be a way to get to Asia. Right, this is, so Columbus, we all say that they thought the world was flat. That's not really the case. They all say that he discovered America, but Columbus, when he died, he insisted that he found the Indies. That's important. Columbus did not conceive of a new world. He believed he'd found Asia. He'd found a route to Asia. So part of the point of the idea of the New World is it wasn't imagined as a new landmass with a new kind of culture. It's still imagined as an extension of the Silk Road somehow. So this is also part of the point of imagination. When you think of the landmass of North America as a new world, there's all kinds of implications to this. The Northwest Passage is once you recognize that there's a big landmass in between Europe and Asia going west. How do you get around this without going south of South America? And this is obviously prior to the Panama Canal.
So, in short, the Northwest Passage is a way to get from Europe to Asia going west.
Right.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
And so that's what I was saying, that they've found a Northwest Passage now that goes, I understand, it's around Greenland and up above, you know, Alaska. So it's not like
ocean mountains.
It's frozen for 18 months of the year.
Not anymore.
Which, then if you learn about the John Franklin expedition, these guys disappeared into the ice. But they were already planning to be stuck in the ice for more than a year. So there's a kind of drive here that I don't think makes a lot of sense.
Was it Lewis and Clark? Their expedition had to do with finding the river that would go through.
Exactly. So this is a long-standing... And so my sort of humorous take on it is the Spanish never understood where they were. They were looking for something that wasn't there. And they didn't find it, so it worked out well.
So then people from Asia just come across the land, and the Europeans couldn't figure out how to follow them back?
Well,
they wanted to go on the water?
I don't know about wanted to.
I mean, that was all it occurred to them to do?
Right. Remember, we're both talking about imagination, right? You look at the old, earliest maps of the world, you know, it does say here there be dragons. But, like, the early Europeans, like, prior to the 1400s, they thought that the world ended at the Canary Islands. That's off the coast of Africa. And there's all these myths about wild men and, you know, the boundaries of the imagined universe, right? And so as that expands, there become different ideas about what you can find, what you can change, what you can seize. And with the sort of colonial outlook that dominated Europe for such a long time and possibly continues to, the constant drive for more is, I mean, that part's, I don't think, of any debate. That's a huge cornerstone of North American culture, is the sense that you can take whatever you want. And it was not, this is not unique to the sort of Protestants, Puritans. This was part of the European expedition into the New World, was, you know, they're not using it, we can take it. And then, of course, part of the underlying assumption of what is the U.S. experiment is exceptionalism, chosen people here to dominate the land. That is a fundamental assumption of the ethos that's promoted in U.S. history.
I think one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is how the stories we're told, particularly in like the U.S. education system, leave out really important details. In your research, have those details fallen off at a variety of points in time, or are there certain points in time where, like, a lot gets erased? Like, in 1880, this happened and a lot got erased. In 1950, this happened and a lot got erased. Like, how is that development of our current narratives, how did that happen?
Well, the part of the reason I always make fun of the education system is because I got a PhD in history. And when I was doing that, I was rereading material about the same story as I learned in kindergarten, only now it was very different. So the story, like, that's why I say 11 years of U.S. history, the history changed every year, and none of it was very comprehensive. So that's part of it. As I've studied this stuff, my own view is people I thought I agreed with or didn't agree with has always changed. Now in terms of, I mean, just the point that we have 11 years of U.S. history and 1 year of world history, in my experience, that's what I went through. You're leaving out an awful lot along the way. And in terms of when I go back over my sources for my PhD program, over and over again, U.S. ideology is based on the assumption of a chosen people. And if you're going to have a story about chosen people of a country that's 278 years old or whatever, you can't be taking into account anything that precedes that in a serious way. And you're obviously not taking into account anything that challenges it along. And you see that in terms of just one of the interesting sort of examples is during World War I and World War II, the role of German Americans. And specifically the role of the German American church. Could the German American church be anti-war? And the answer was generally no, because there was all kinds of bias against German Americans during the two global conflicts where Germany was an antagonist of the United States. So that's just one example more recently of something that, you know, we don't talk about that. But it's, I mean, Germanic people are part of the story from the beginning as well. And you see it in terms of food and culture and language in many cities and states in the country. And yet we have what sort of stereotypes and you know, easy ways to accuse somebody of being German. This is just an example. So, you know, is there one time that's more less comprehensive than others? I think everything. You know, the War of 1812 is another example. That's, never mind. There's a lot to this, and you know, one of the stories I really like, he offers this idea of ethnic recovery. He calls ethnic recovery something in the latter half of the 20th century, where people start to, they're born in America, the United States, they live in the United States, their culture is shared a lot with the dominant culture in the United States, but all of a sudden it's, you know, oh, I'm a this American, or a that American, or I locate my sort of mythic history somewhere else I've never been to before. So all of a sudden it becomes good to claim a mixed history that doesn't really relate to what you experience on the ground. That's sort of off topic, but the point is that this is why I say that the United States has always been diverse. The Americas were diverse before they were the United States. This sort of claim that we're becoming diverse and that we need to suddenly become more tolerant of each other is a false premise, because we've all already been here. And that's the, for me, the turning point is, what does it mean to be a human being rather than a citizen of this or that? And how can we celebrate what makes us really rich and strong is all the places that we come from. Let's see here. We go till 5, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Okay. Anything else you want to ask?
What would be a good source of history?
Well, so the best book that I found is by Sidney Ahlstrom. It's called, a religious history of the American people. And it's 1,182 pages long. You know, a good history is one that I think raises questions and tries to revisit. And that's why I always probably would talk more about this. This is one of my professors, Daisy Machado. She talks about the Disciples of Christ in Texas. And she, I have her on the next slide. One of her, basically, she's building on Herbert Eugene Bolton's idea of the Spanish borderlands as a lost past in some ways. She also talks about a usable past, right? This is very important, a usable past where you locate a story that makes sense of your experience in a way that you can use. And she's concerned with, what about the people? What about the people that are on the land? All this stuff's happening, the powers are trading and selling and giving away, conquering. What happens to the people on the land that were already there? And in this case, when you talk about Texas, there's a third culture, at least, developing there in between Spain and England and the indigenous and the African. All of these things are mixing together. And so that's what she is concerned about, mestizo Tejano, which for the first time combines Indian, Black, and European blood. And that's why there's a list of all the words that relate to cowboys in the Texas region that are Spanish words that become English words, like stampede, or cincho, or lariat. All these different words that we associate with cowboy culture come from Spanish words. And that goes before you get into chocolate and tomatoes and all these other things, or the way that Europeans brought horses to the New World and introduced the indigenous people to them. So when Machado is talking about Texas, the state, we all know the state of Texas, she's talking about a very specific, a space, a borderland space where a third culture has developed over time. And when Texas ceases to be part of Mexico and becomes independent and then is taken over by the United States, there are people on that land that don't understand themselves as U.S. Americans. What happens to them? They're from there. They were born there. They lived there. And all of a sudden, what's their identity supposed to be? So, are you a Spanish citizen, a Mexican citizen, a Texan? And there are other examples in the 20th century where similar things happened, where lines on the map were redrawn and all of a sudden you became somebody else without even trying, right? And just so we don't lose it, the Holden Village is a very interesting example in the fact that none of us would be up here if it wasn't for a mining company. I think we can safely say that mining aims at some capacity to exploit the earth, and generally without a great deal of concern with the aftermath of that. All pointed to by the remediation efforts and the cost of those remediation efforts and all of that, but yet here we have this this village with a conscious effort to live together in connection with the earth and the animals and each other in this place that you can't get to unless you walk, right? Get it? Swim and then walk? Never mind. What I'm trying to say is that what was here before relates to where we are now. And so it's interesting to be in this environment to talk about some of this, because in a place like New York City, there was obviously a city before, New Amsterdam. But before it was New Amsterdam, it was something else. And that's part of what I am trying to do with my work in history, is to say, we got to take seriously what happened before, because it informs who we are even if we don't understand it. And that's part of what the residue is. And that's part of why I ask about our mother's mother. Because, you know, time runs in all directions, as it were. Okay. Other questions?
I guess I'm just thinking about, what in a utopian world, what is the role of a border? Would there not be a border? What do you think the importance, if any, is of a border?
Well, so, I realize I didn't ask what is a border, but it's interesting also, geography, right? When a mountain range actually is a border, partly because it's impossible to get over. And then there's areas of linguistic difference, or religious conflict, or historical animosity, and the importance of, for like persecuted groups, of having a space in which to exist without being interfered with constantly. And in this moment of the great coronavirus outbreak of 2020, all of a sudden it's like, whoa. You know, somebody crosses a border infected with this thing and it affects everybody. So how important is the border in these contexts? And how much is it about political power and saying this is the line and nobody can cross it? So in terms of, I don't have an answer to that question, but I don't have an answer to any questions, because part of my goal is to raise questions and to say, what roles do borders serve? And is there a way for it to be a more humane thing? Because there's been borders as long as there's been people in one way or another. But is it a place of tremendous pain and conflict? Which, of course, so Gloria Anzaldúa refers to the border as an open wound, and she's also talking about a geographical area that's most susceptible to La Mezcla, neither fully of Mexico nor of the United States. She's talking about the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And she's a feminist theoretician, a Chicana theoretician. She has a very radical approach to her own experience growing up in the United States on the border, where, you know, she's told not to speak Spanish. She's told that her Spanish is no good by other Spanish speakers. She lays out 9 different languages that she speaks depending on who she's talking to. And I don't like to read her words for her because they're not mine, so to speak. And I have a wonderful video that's online that we're not going to show because we're not online. But Anzaldúa talks about her language and her identity, and constantly being told that she's an other. I think she's also talking about the psychological implications of this. What do you do when you're constantly being told you're not this, you're not that, well, who are you? And here it is. And again, I'm not going to read it, because it's not my words. So, you know, in a way, this is a jump from what we were talking about, and that now you're talking about something very tangible. And the experience of, like I said, the city of El Paso, Texas, is not, there's not a lot of difficulty around the mixing there. There's a lot of Spanish culture and language, Mexican culture and language, and there's also Anglo culture and language, and it's all there together. And the city, in my experience, never had a kind of, it's not to say that there's not historical sort of racial prejudice and so forth, because there, as long as we've framed people in this way, there's been tension. But El Paso is a place where it is more of a mixed identity already. And it's literally, there's a park in El Paso that's also in Mexico. And I always liked that as an idea, a park that's in 2 countries. And if you travel around the world, when you come to border zones in different countries, you know, different things happen in those spaces. And there's some places where, you know, along the border, multiple languages are spoken on both sides, and people have a culture that is different than either of the 2 countries in which they're in. And Anzaldúa is talking about, you know, growing up as a woman, a lesbian woman in the United States, as a Mexican-American person, and all of the ways that she feels like society is trying to colonize her. And it's...
This extends further into the U.S. than the border. I grew up in Seattle. I grew up being called Carl Aguero instead of Carlos, which is what my name is. My father wouldn't speak Spanish to me because I was a gringo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is in Seattle.
Right.
And, I actually was ashamed of being a Mexican. Mm-hmm. It turns out I don't have any Mexican ancestry. I have Spanish ancestry, genetically.
And that sums up a major part of my goal today. What does it mean to say you are who you understand yourself to be? And how important is it to be recognized? Versus to be told, you are not enough of this. And, right, and there's a whole different part of that between, like, actual systematized, you know, racist attitudes of saying, you know, you don't have value because of your background, whether you identify it as it or not. And that's a big, that's the power in the production of history part. There's systematic efforts to stop black people from voting in the United States. There's also, of course, is my next question, is what is a citizen?
Generally, it's somebody born in that country, or whatever geographical definition you want to give to the thing, or they've gone through some formal process to, right? I mean, that's how we...
To people from that.
So it's status related to a country.
Yeah. I mean...
Conferred by a country.
Yeah.
Okay, so identity given to you from externally. What else is a citizen?
I guess in a non-legal framework, it's a participant in a community sometimes. Mm-hmm. That would be another. Mm-hmm.
Right, a participant in a community?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. When I hear that word, it always has political context, though it has to do with belonging to a particular political entity, a country.
And you'll note that the founding documents of the United States aren't really talking about citizens, they're talking about the people of. Right? So one of my legal sources talks about citizenship. What does it mean in terms of, you say, what does it represent? Does it just mean that you can vote? Because that's kind of what it appears to mean at this point.
Can fight in the war.
Can be taxed.
Right, but people that are not citizens are still taxed.
That's true. Yeah.
So, and then, of course, the point that she raises is in relation to Hurricane Katrina. And she puts Hurricane Katrina in relation to Plessy versus Ferguson and Dred Scott. These, of course, are legal definitions of what a citizen or a person is under the U.S. law. And so in case of Hurricane Katrina, what was demonstrated by this disaster? That people that are supposedly citizens of the U.S. Were not cared for by the state. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's clear implications to that. But what the question is raised then is, well, what does it mean to be a citizen? Does it come with anything positive? And then, of course, you get into... never mind. Nothing. Okay. Now for some action. So there's another wonderful movie that I've not been able to get in its physical form. It's called Chulas Fronteras. It means lovely borders, or some version of that. And it opens with a very similar image. This guy is talking about he lives in Texas, but he calls himself a Texas Mexican. But when he meets other people from Mexico, he doesn't call himself a Mexican because he lives in Texas. He's lived in Texas his whole life. Texas, that, as we pointed out, you know, the line was not always the solid way that it was. I mean, prior to the Mexican-American War, it wasn't there at all. And so what does it mean to be a Mexican-American? Or, in this case. And so this is where it's important to understand a little bit about labor. The basic role of Mexican immigration to the United States has always tied directly to labor. And let's talk a little bit about that. When in the early 1900s they passed a lot of laws trying to exclude Asian immigrants and limiting immigrants from Eastern Europe in light of the World Wars, Mexican laborers, there was never a border in the way that we think of it now. It was kind of a zone where people went back and forth all the time. People continue to go back and forth all the time. But so the point is, when you exclude labor from Asia and Eastern Europe, then you have jobs that need to be filled. So this becomes a historic place for Mexican labor in the U.S. And this is a basis for agriculture, the railroads, all kinds of different markets. And so, prior to 1965, there's no restriction on Mexican laborers coming into the United States or getting jobs or being hired. And so when you start to put, so part of the point is that most of the laws and most of the punitive systems in the country against immigration are aimed at Mexican immigrants. And yet Mexican immigrants are the largest portion of migrant people in the U.S. So not only does this not stop immigration, but what it does is creates a sort of legal category where, and this is sort of the point, if you have, and this is the case, if you have 1 million jobs that need to be filled in agriculture and other places, but you say that only 18,000 people from Mexico can legally get jobs, right? You have 18,000 legal jobs that can be got, and 988,000 jobs that need to be filled. Somebody is going to be hired. So the point is that there's been a sort of legislative establishment of a kind of revolving door process where people cannot become legal workers in the U.S., but they still need jobs. And in fact, we'll get jobs because somebody is going to get hired. And so part of the point is the Border Patrol was actually under the control of the Department of Labor when it was founded. The Border Patrol was founded by the Department of Labor. And then the Bracero program in a post-World War II setting when, well, I guess it's during World War II, when they lost a lot of laborers because of the war, the Bracero program was a guest worker program to bring in labor. This was overseen by the Department of Agriculture. So there's always a direct correlation between our immigration policy and labor. And as there's a long history in human history, a long trend of targeting immigrants, or people from a foreign place. This goes back 1,000 years or more, usually to a political end. You raise a fear of a certain group of foreigners. And certainly since 1965, that's when they changed the immigration laws to be more punitive, specifically towards, well, okay, that's not exactly right. In 1965, they ended the Bracero program, the guest worker program, and they said that they were sort of liberalizing immigration law at large. So this was more positive towards people coming from Asia or Eastern Europe, but it becomes more punitive towards Mexican laborers. Mexican laborers who prior to this point were in many cases born in Texas or lived in the Southwest, their family was there, their culture was there. This was not a boundary in the way that we think of it now. You go back to those early maps we looked at. The line was not there the way that it is. And so when you change that, you have this huge population of laborers coming in and going out. All of a sudden it becomes much harder to do this. And what is actually created, arguably, is, obviously a super vulnerable population. They're coming for work. They cannot be legalized. They do not have any rights. So it's not actually being deported that's the danger. It's the fact that you are deportable. And once again, when you look at the revolving door process, when you need labor, you're bringing in labor, it also creates space for smuggling or a black market. And when they finally pass laws saying, well, we are going to check employers whether or not they've checked if their laborers have documentation, this gives rise to the possibility of false documentation. It's an entire industry. And at the same time, all you have to do if a business that hires people, all they have to do is prove that they asked. So the burden does not fall on business at any point along the way. It falls on the people. And then prior to 1965, as already suggested, there was absolutely no qualitative restriction on legal migration from Mexico. Okay. So then you have, right, in the 90s there was Proposition 187 in California, showing all of the hordes crossing the border near San Diego. So Bill Clinton signed in a thing called Operation Gatekeeper. And what they did is they put in more restrictions on that area, the area right next to San Diego. It's a 12-mile stretch. There's no mountains. It's not in the middle of the desert. And then they said, oh, look, we've decreased all of the amount of people crossing the border. But what you also saw was a huge increase in every other zone along the border of people crossing. So traditionally, what you can see is that trying to restrict people crossing the border does not lower the number of people crossing the border. It just shifts where people are going. And part of the argument is where this was a relatively safe place to cross, the mountains and the desert are not, people die, and they know this. 7,286 people died between 1994 and 2017 trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, which was not a border always. And then one of the other questions has to do with why do people come to the U.S.? Almost exclusively they come for work, for economic opportunities. And then there's the huge influence that has already been played, as I've said, by business, agribusiness. And people seeking what is a vulnerable and cheap labor population. So sort of the system as it is cannot do without these laborers, but it also works to keep them in a very vulnerable position. And this is all obviously speaking about a situation prior to 2016. And it's interesting, if you look at the Border Patrol's website, they talk about all the great success they've had in basically locking people up, which on a given year will be 700,000 people. So 700,000 people are caught illegally crossing the border and, you know, imprisoned or deported. And let's not fool ourselves by thinking that that's a majority of the people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And this is where just the numbers really give you pause when you think about it this way. It's, this is, they caught 700,000 people in 1996. And these are people that maybe cross again or are across six times for all we know. When there's a huge other number of people that are not caught, not stopped, and then get jobs and work and pay taxes. And all of this is part of a cycle. And all the while, of course, the image of Mexicans as illegals and the assumption that a Mexican person is an illegal person. And what does an illegal person mean? It means you don't have rights. It means that you've committed a crime. And the crime, of course, is against the state. So all of this is creating, and obviously I started with the whole map and the history of Spanish America and the mixing of cultures and so on and so forth to say, this is a category that has been constructed. And it's used in a very destructive way. And when you look at, it's also important, I mentioned the black market, it's important to look at the way that the amount of resources that go into enforcing regulations. Right, there's a tremendous business in policing the border. There's a tremendous business in building barriers and surveillance. And before you even have privatized prisons, there's a great deal of economic incentive to have places to lock people up. And once again, when you look at the huge drive to fill jobs that need to be done by somebody, and then the sort of question is, if we really cared about illegal immigration, the real thing that we should be worried about is how much people get paid to do minimum wage jobs. Because if people were paid, if you were able to make a living wage doing these jobs, you wouldn't have to do any of these other things. And that, of course, ties into the economy of Mexico and all the ways that it's not possible to make a living wage there either. And obviously this is not just a story about Mexico, because it's a story of migration to the United States as possibly one of the founding ideas behind what the United States even is, or what the Americas are, or why it was a promised land in the imagination to begin with. And so, I have a whole bunch of other things to say, which I won't. We are going to watch this movie. Comes with a book. It's called Al Hombrista. It is a film from 1979, I believe. And it tells a story of an undocumented worker who comes to the U.S. and works in different places. And
was the movie made in 79, or was it about somebody that...
It was
lived
made
that
in 79. Okay. So a brief summary before we get to questions. Okay, so what I've hopefully covered at some point is the idea of borderlands as a way of thinking about our past. And it impacts not just the land and the geography and the legal implications, but it impacts who we are, how we understand ourselves. And so New York City is one of my great examples, because I love the story of it being New Amsterdam and the Dutch saying, oh, we're not, that's an economic backwater. We don't need to defend it heavily. It becomes the center of modern capitalism, perhaps. And the old Broadway down the middle of New York City is a thing in Dutch cities called the Hoogstraat, the main road that cuts diagonally across the city. So when you're in New York City, you're also in New Amsterdam. I have a whole thing about Santa Fe, which we didn't talk about today, but this is a place that continues to reenact its founding as the oldest settlement in North America, continually inhabited, and the conflict over whose story do they tell. Do they tell the Spanish story? Do they tell the indigenous story? Do they tell the Anglo story? I have a borderlands context. As I've already mentioned, I come from all of these different places, and we carry around the meanings of the past in our bodies and in our memories. And that relates to our journey across the earth. As I suggested at the beginning, you are a borderlands context because of your mother's mother and all of the different languages and cultural things that you bring. And Holden Village, as a former mining village, before it was a mining village, it was just the bears and the birds and the meerkats, whatever. Good. So that's sort of my presentation. I want to make sure we have time for a conversation or questions if you have any. And we're going to watch this movie this evening if you want to come.
What time?
It's at 7. Questions, comments?
So is this labor practices of making people illegal and suppressing them and making them have no rights just another form of slavery?
Well, that raises the question of what was the real impetus for abolishing slavery in the first place. My understanding is Eric Williams argues that the real purpose behind it is economic, whereas if you have a labor force that you own, you have to care for them enough to keep them alive. But if you have a workforce that you hire, they have to buy everything from you, and you don't care if they die because you can hire somebody else. Eric Williams aside, the idea that you can have a workforce, the difficulty which one has in modern society of even caring for oneself, working full-time or two jobs or whatever it is, and inaccessibility to health care, there's something deeply concerning about what that says about, well, human rights, but specifically, let's look at from the category of a citizen of a state. As a citizen, you're not protected or guaranteed any kind of quality of life. And that's not even to talk about people who you say, well, these are illegal people. They're breaking the law, so we don't have to, you know. And that's the framework of saying somebody doesn't deserve any rights. And that it's okay to do whatever you want with them. I don't know if slavery is there's something deeply concerning about this in terms of what our society is doing and will do. And that's one of the other questions is, who will we allow to be put in a cage?
The Mexicans.
Apparently. But then you can look at the prison system as well, and 1 in 4 prisoners is Latino, and I don't know the rest of the stats, but the point is, it's acceptable in our society to put people in cages. And we allow this.
And make money off of them.
Other questions?
Do you have any book recommendations for the evolution of immigration law from the 1960s to present?
Probably not in the way that you put it, but I have all kinds of possible resources.
Cool.
So.
I can talk to you later.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
And we're going to wrap up. I'll be here all week if you want to tell me I'm wrong or ask other questions or discuss it more. I always like to do that. So I just want to say, I don't think this is going to be the end story, that we all just sort of rotted away as a society and showed no concern. Because that's part of why I talk about the borderlands as a lens. because when we start to understand all of the historical realities that contribute to who we are, that's the real history. It's not a one-sided thing of xenophobic claims of returning to a purity of an America long lost. That's not the real story at all. It never was. The real story is, it's collision, it's conflict, it's struggle, but that is what makes the Americas great. And that's the story that I'm going to tell, and that's the story that I think we can explore together. One that tries to make space for other voices, tries to privilege other retellings of this story, and try to locate what our responsibility is to not only the narrative, but to how we relate to one another. And that is what I have to say. So thank you for coming. I'm happy to talk about any of this at length, and I will be here all week.